Thanks for joining Current State today. This is 90.5 WKAR. Current State comes your way every day, every weekday, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. and every weekday at noon on AM 870. Don't forget Current State Weekend with Emmanuel Berry on Saturday and Sunday, too. Later this hour, Emmanuel talks with food author Peggy Wolf, whose latest is on Midwest cuisine. And what a title to this book, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie. Is that a title or is that a title? Also, we'll talk with the president of the president of the Friends of Turner Dodge, Michael Beebe, about this year's Old Town Festival of Trees. And the Turner Dodge Mansion is the focal point of that. Live music also this hour coming up from friends and musicians at the MSU Community School of Music. At the top of the program today, Governor Rick Snyder wants a no-regrets energy future for Michigan. That was how he summarized his administration's long-awaited energy blueprint, which was released yesterday. The governor's recommendations come after nearly a year's worth of public meetings around the state at which citizens and groups aired their views. Those discussions were summarized in a series of four reports Mr. Snyder used to create his blueprint. Now, this blueprint comes before next year's legislative debate that's expected to include a proposal to hike the state's renewable energy standard and all kinds of other topics. Joining us today to respond to yesterday's report, James Clift, policy director of the Michigan Environmental Council. Welcome back to Current State, James.
Hello, Mark. Pleasure to join you.
MEC's press release yesterday suggested your organization is encouraged by the governor's energy blueprint. What exactly triggers that encouragement?
We think it's an excellent framework for moving forward for Michigan. You know, this idea of moving from coal to cleaner sources of energy, doing it in a way that's going to reduce those health impacts we've been talking about for many years, and at the same time, increasing economic development opportunities in Michigan, creating more jobs based on this growing sector of our economy, kind of the clean energy sector.
And Governor Snyder again calls for an increase in the renewable energy portfolio. That's the amount of electricity the state will generate through renewable sources as opposed to coal. And he calls for a reduction in the use of coal. This whole topic begs one of the key questions. What should Michigan's renewable energy portfolio standard be for 2025? He didn't identify it in his blueprint. How do you feel about that?
You know, if you read the Public Service Commission report, they talked about 30% by 2035. You know, so if you look at, we're at 10% today, that would mean, you know, he might be thinking the range of 20% by 2025. We think somewhere in that 20 to 25% by 2025 is the right number. Kind of keep this nice, steady transition to renewable energy, the path that we've been on for the last 5 years.
Now, the report also calls for Michigan electricity customers, residential customers, to pay less for electricity and natural gas than the national average. How forward-looking a recommendation is that?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, kind of a new frame to look at this at. Michigan residents use 38% more than the national average for energy. So, you know, that sounds very ambitious to get up to that, being above that national
average.
It does. But if you look at the actual cost, we're only 6% above the national average. That's because our use of natural gas is a cheaper form of energy than some of the other energy used around the country. So this is very achievable. And you start to kind of look at the numbers, it's kind of interesting. You look at like residential houses in Michigan, 2/3 of the windows, double pane glass, 1/3 of them still single pane glass on the window. So if you think about replacing those single pane glass, you know, increasing the insulation, more energy efficient appliances, this is very achievable in the time frame he's talking about.
There's also been an ongoing discussion here for greater competition in Michigan's electrical market. Will this be a part of the discussion next year?
I don't think we can avoid it being part of the discussion. The legislature's been talking about it for years. The governor seemed cool on the idea. I think he has sold that our regulated system is a good system. Clearly, a lot of talk about affordability and get a better control on cost. But he didn't mention anything yesterday that would hint toward an increase in that customer choice program.
Interesting. Will fracking in Michigan be a part of this 2014 discussion?
I see it as kind of a separate discussion. Really, as we're looking at fracking, we're looking at how can we do it in a way that protects Michigan's water resources. That's really kind of separate from the issue of how much natural gas we use. Obviously, the governor is saying we should use more natural gas, cleaner than coal, less of the emissions that are causing those health impacts. But I think we're just kind of a small player in the national market for natural gas. So, again, I think they see that exploration of natural gas being separate from which energy sources are we going to use to create energy.
We're talking with James Clift, who's policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council, and we're talking about Governor Snyder's energy blueprint yesterday. He says he wants a no-regrets energy future for Michigan by 2025. Other organizations, environmental organizations yesterday, Clean Energy Now was one, criticized Governor Snyder for a lack of specifics and concrete goals. Do they have a point?
You know, I think you've been looking at it, you've been studying this for a year, and there's no real specific numbers, you know, except for those like being above national averages and things like that. So I think we could have seen more specifics, but at the end of the day, it's going to have to be the administration working with the legislature, working with the stakeholders to try to build a consensus package that puts those numbers in there. You know, is it 20% renewable energy by 2025, 25%? Do we set minimums and then allow the price of these various energy sources to determine a little flexibility as we move forward? Number of different ways we can get there.
How closely do you think the Snyder administration has already been talking with the legislature about the bigger issues involved here? Do you think those conversations have begun? Are positions already plotted out for this, or are those really in flux right now?
I think the discussions have probably begun. You know, Senator Mike Knopf is chair of the Senate Energy Committee. Representative Eric Nesbitt, chair of the House Energy Committee, both smart guys, know this field really well. I'm sure there's been some discussion, some back and forth between them, but I think it's kind of that separation of powers. You know, the governor is kind of leading the state, saying, hey, this is where I think we should be going. And now it's up to the legislature to craft the actual policies that would go into Michigan law moving forward.
Did either of the energy chairmen respond yesterday to the blueprint?
I've seen no response yet. I've heard some talk of starting hearings after the beginning of the year, but I haven't seen any direct response.
Okay. Would MEC have preferred more detail in the energy blueprint?
Oh, I think, you know, we're always looking for detail. We intervene in utility rate cases. We're down in the minutiae when it comes into energy costs. So we always want to jump to that. How are we going to implement this? How are we going to get this done in Michigan? So, again, we're really looking forward to starting this legislative debate.
I'm really curious here. I mean, the Republican Legislative Caucus is arguably more conservative than Governor Snyder. How receptive do you feel the caucus will be generally to this discussion?
I think they're going to be receptive because really a bipartisan call for this. Earlier this week, I'm not sure you saw, a group of conservative got together calling for, you know, green, cleaner energy moving forward. A new group in Michigan, kind of what you considered more conservative than the governor, calling for this. You know, the faith-based groups, the churches have been calling for this. You know, we've got really people across the political spectrum calling for this transition to cleaner energy. So I think there's a lot of cover for everyone. I don't think this breaks down into Republican, Democrat, or conservative, liberal. I think everyone's really looking to continue this transition we've been on.
I have to ask you about the controversy involving James Hansen. I intended to spend most of our time talking about response to the governor's blueprint, but have you followed the James Hansen comment involving increasing nuclear power?
We have been in on that discussion.
Well, for our listeners, James Hansen's one of the world's most prominent climate scientists. Last month, he created quite a stir when he issued a call for more nuclear power around the world. And the reason is he claims that the transition to renewable sources of energy cannot happen fast enough at this point to avert serious damage to the climate, to climate disaster, really. And he says we should compensate for that by developing more safe nuclear, he calls it. What do you make of that?
Again, I think if you look at our track record of building nuclear power in this country, it has not been a fast process. I tend to disagree with him. I think we can ramp up renewables just as quickly as we can ramp up nuclear power, and with probably less impact on the environment and at a cost which is lower. And I think that's the important part is right now nuclear power is costing 3 to 5 times more than renewable power. So the question is would there be some pushback from people's pocketbooks if you followed his dictate of going into more nuclear power? So again, I think where the governor sees it as affordability, you know, cleaner energy moving forward, I think he's on the right track.
We are on the brink of a very interesting, long-ranging discussion about energy here in Michigan, and we've been talking about the governor's blueprint issued yesterday with James Clift, Policy Director of the Michigan Environmental Council. James, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Live holiday music from Studio S here at WKAR. Our players this morning all hail from the MSU Community School of Music. Sam Ives, Genevieve Brown, Michelle Hibbert, Sarah Heft, Marissa Olin, and Judy Turbrack. We thank them very much, and we're going to hear more from them later this hour. It's Current State on WKAR. The holidays can be a stressful time in and of themselves, but now some Michigan residents are bracing for more difficulty. About 45,000 people in the state who are currently receiving unemployment insurance through a federal extension program will lose that benefit by the end of the month. That's because Republicans in the U.S. House opted not to extend the program in the latest budget package passed this week. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with one such person who's losing that funding this month, and Kevin joins me now in the studio to talk about it. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. As you said, this cut in federal spending affects nearly 45,000 people in Michigan who receive unemployment insurance through the federal government. This is above and beyond the 20 weeks that the state of Michigan issues to recipients. As I was researching this story, it really was quite difficult to find people who are being affected by this. The agencies that deal with unemployment insurance do not release the names of their clients. It's a confidentiality, a proprietary issue. Finally, though, after a lot of phone calls, I did find a woman in Lansing whose attitude about her impending situation just might surprise and maybe even inspire you. I met Daphne Whitfield at a local church, the Tabernacle of David in South Lansing. Before I even walked in, I was greeted by a loudspeaker piping out cheery holiday music and rooftops dripping with slushy, melting icicles. It must have been the warmth radiating out from the people inside.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
76 kids total so far.
Daphne Whitfield is a staff volunteer at Tabernacle of David, And on this day, I found her preparing to send donated toys to the city's less fortunate children. She's an ordained minister, though not here. It's a vocation she's followed nearly 25 years.
I really believe that you're supposed to just be expendable. You know, put your hands where it's most needed at. So I pretty much know ministry from the administrative side to it, the actual hands-on approach with the people, and I love all of it.
Whitfield is head of her own business, Daphne Whitfield Ministries, but it's not a full-time paying career. In fact, she doesn't have one right now. Daphne Whitfield is one of some 45,000 Michigan residents who's losing her federal monthly unemployment insurance at the end of the month.
How long have you had that federal assistance?
I got laid off for lack of work in 2011, July of 2011. And from that point, I went on what's considered to be the extension, what's getting ready to get cut off. And so I was really shocked. I thought I had unemployment until July of next year. Usually, traditionally, I spend December planning for my next year, my first 6 months of the year. And so I'm planning on, you know, setting myself up so that I can launch a couple of endeavors as well as possibly work for someone else because I knew it was going to be running out. And so when I found out that it actually had been cut off, I was kind of surprised because I do it on the phone and it's really been messing up since they rolled out this new system. I thereafter went to the office and then found out that mines had actually been cut off. And it was pretty much shocking because, you know, I'm right in the middle of not so much the Christmas holidays, but I just had, you know, my rent and everything else that is due. So, you know, it wasn't the amount of money that I'm accustomed to, but it has really afforded me to do some things that I wanted to do in my life right now that I'm not going to be able to do.
And if I may ask, about how much money were you receiving through the federal insurance?
Okay. It first started off, I was receiving $324, $344, something like that a month. It has gone down incrementally and had went to $290 and had gone down again. So it went down a lot. I was receiving like seven something at one time. This last check that I was receiving for months was probably about $590, and that's for every 2 weeks. Now, I know that's not anything to work with because I'm accustomed to making very good money.
But throughout her varied career as a minister, a training consultant, even a ghostwriter, Whitfield has also learned to get by on very little. Now at 48, she's reinventing herself again, this time as a full-time college student.
The thing that I have enjoyed the most about being in school, more than anything, is that it's caused me to build skill sets, learn new knowledge. The thing that I have liked the least, that I felt like the system lacks for an adult learner, is you give me academics and I'm fine, but life has beat me down. How can you motivate me and encourage me on how to do dream when I don't have any motivation? How to fight for something new when I've lost everything? Those are the components that my life gives to people in order for them to know that irregardless, to give them the fortitude, to give them the, re-give them the self-confidence, the self-worth, the self-esteem. That's what a lot of people have lost that I've learned from being on campus. With people that are adult learners, like, oh my God, I'm 48, 50 years old. I'm supposed to be settling in 5-10 years away from retirement. I am literally starting my life all over again. I lost everything, Kevin, every single thing, everything. Had to sell everything, lost every single thing. And have learned a lot, have learned after making 50, you know, plus $1,000 a year with no degree, coming in and going to unemployment, and before they cut it off, $13,000 a year is what I've been living on. But if you give me a salary now that triples that, I know how to live off that $13,000 still and take care of my debt from school and not feel frustrated about it because I've learned how to keep myself looking good, keep myself doing what I desire to do, maintaining my personal self-worth while I had little. And I've really learned what makes life rich. And it's not necessarily what money is, you can get it over and over again. It's what you do and how you touch people's lives. And so that's my mantra, how I live my life.
With no regular income and the impending loss of her unemployment check, Whitfield realizes her economic situation is undoubtedly going to get worse. Still, she's quick to credit the support of her family and friends. As it turns out, there's a few people in her life who are also losing their unemployment insurance.
What are they saying and thinking and feeling, and how are you talking with them about it?
Well, there are a couple friends of mine as well, and a lot of them are in school. You know, we're the student learners that had to come in because we are what the industry in terms of employment calls the dislocated person. The person that has worked in an area of industry for 5-10 years, then the industry closes up because of the economy. Now we have to review where we're at, redo our skill sets in order to get, you know, ourselves together. Their situation is different than mine, where they might have other worries because I'm a single person. So you're talking about people that are married, that have kids, and they're like, oh my God, I don't want to put all of this weight on my husband. I don't want to put, you know, so, you know, they have those additional worries and concerns, but we come together and we brainstorm. I call it excellent ideals. So we all get together to hold each other accountable. And I was like, okay, we need to do this formally. So I came up with this, you know, I have a dream day every Monday where I think about exhausting who I am and how I can help somebody. Came up with an endeavor called Excellent Ideals. And this is, instead of EX, it's EGG. And it's, we help each other to crack open each other's dreams. We come and we put whatever gifts and talents we have into the basket for somebody to be able to come. So if I'm a writer, I give you my writing. And if you have computer skills, you give me your computer skills. So this is an endeavor that we came. So we come together and we talk about it, kind of mesh. And then the different perspectives helps us to remain balanced. So we're not like, oh, my God, I'm going to fly off a building. Oh, my God. You know, so we help to bring each other and give each other balance. So it's really been kind of good that we've connected and that we're so all kind of like in the same boats. But our friendships have kind of really helped us out.
Whitfield is already looking beyond this setback to her next career move. She wants to design and sell her own clothing line.
I am currently working right now on a teen or youth clothing line that I want to bring out, launch next year. And it's really what I consider to be motivational. It's a sports line comparable to some of the things that are already out there, but more focused on helping young ladies to fortify their internal persons and not so much their out. So I'm going to do it in a really very unique, marketable way that will be able to reach them and have them be happy about being who they are and not so comparative and trying to be like everybody else.
The Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program expires on the 28th. As the date draws near, Daphne Whitfield prefers not to see it as a lump of Christmas coal today, but as a diamond tomorrow.
A diamond is only created by pressure, right? Okay, this is pressure. This is where I exercise my faith. I mean, we've all been in this place before. There's not nobody that's listening on the radio right now that has never been in that place like, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. I can't believe that this happened to me. What am I going to do? That might have been 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 months ago, but you're still here. And, you know, that's the way it is for me. I'm still here, and I'm going to be all the better by the time it's all over with. So I'm good.
Daphne Whitfield, I am very grateful for your time.
Thank you.
You've got a great attitude about this, and I think you're pointing out a good example to many people.
Thank you. I really, really enjoyed my time with you today, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Live music here today on Current State, live from Studio S, from players affiliated with the MSU Community Music School. Kristen Florey, Sam Ives, Genevieve Brown, Michelle Hibbert, Sarah Heft, Marissa Olin, and Judy Turbrack. It has sounded fantastic, and we thank them. We've got more music coming up later this hour from the MSU Community Music School. You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. When we discuss food culture in the U.S., we typically think of the chic restaurants on the East or West Coast. People don't often make overtures about Midwestern food staples like meatloaf, but a new book is trying to change the way people understand Midwestern cuisine. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with the author of Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie. Emmanuel, what'd you learn about our region's food culture here?
Well, When I think about Midwestern food, I think about tuna noodle casserole that my mom makes. You know, heavy, hearty food, carbs and meat. And while this book does embrace kind of that Midwestern staples of meat and potatoes, it also kind of expands beyond that a bit.
So what type of recipes are in this book then?
Well, there actually aren't many recipes in the book. There are a couple, but it's actually a book filled with stories that just happen to be about food. So there's things like odes to meatloaf, lemon meringue pie, fudge, and the fish boil in Door County in Wisconsin, which I've never heard of, but apparently it's delicious. So when I spoke to the book's author, Peggy Wolf, she said that she wrote the book because she wanted to kind of share these Midwestern food treasures that are often overlooked.
What I began to see after I had moved back to the Midwest that every single food trend that you can see on either coast is happening here. I mean, we don't have Meyer lemons that grow in alleys like they do in California, and we can't grow pomegranates because we're restricted to our weather and our geography. But I felt that the Midwest was underappreciated. It is underrepresented, and it's really a hidden gem, and we get a bad rap.
You start this book by writing this introduction about your own kind of introduction into the world of food. You receive a letter from a lady who you say is second only to Eleanor Roosevelt at the time, from Betty Crocker. Tell us what happened.
I learned that Eleanor Roosevelt, who was over in Kenya, was trying to improve the flour over there, and she was writing to Betty Crocker. Betty Crocker, in my generation, is the Martha Stewart of today. So to sit down and write Betty a letter because my chocolate chip cookies didn't come out, I mean, this is what we did in my family. And I got a package back from Betty, and to see this wrapped package on my doorstep from Betty, it just was, it just launched me, and I thought, I'm good to go. I'm in the kitchen, you know. She was a celebrity, and I felt I was rubbing elbows with Betty Crocker.
When you think of the Midwest and Midwestern food, you think of kind of this really hearty, heavy food. Like, I think of my mom's tuna noodle casserole. How do you define Midwestern food?
Well, I think you can look at tradition, and I think you can look at change. Because so many of our traditions in the Midwest have been brought to us by immigrants. The Door County fish boil. You cannot go to Door County and not go to a fish boil. It's like you haven't done Door unless you do. I think Chicago is Chicago. I don't even think, although there are chefs here who are reviving Midwestern cuisine, I do think of protein and carbohydrates. I think of meat and potatoes. And I have always thought of that as the Midwest. I've been crisscrossing through Iowa and Indiana and so on, and have been at wonderful restaurants that have the best fried chicken I've ever had, the best pork tenderloin sandwiches ever. I think Midwesterners still want meat and potatoes.
Did working on this book at all change your definition of Midwestern food?
Yes, it did. Because you have a restaurant up in Kalamazoo called Food Dance, and I've eaten there a few times. I was watching the trend of whole animal butchering, which has come to Kalamazoo. I mean, these folks bring in the entire animal into the back room, and they dismantle it there. They are not buying meats that are shrink-wrapped on a styrofoam tray, okay? Which I think used to be the way that restaurants had ordered food many, many, many years ago. But this was a change, whole animal butchering, and I see it all over the country. So a lot of the trends that I'd seen, eat local, eat the least traveled food, this is happening here in the Midwest. It's happening on either coast, too, but it is also happening here.
As you mentioned, there are these trends, but there is this hearkening back to nostalgia. And I think that the first story in this collection really gets at that. It's about meatloaf, of all things. The writer Elizabeth Berg, she manages to make meatloaf sound romantic, if that's possible. She writes, "There used to be a lot of support for serving meatloaf. I'm sure the Stones and the Cleavers had it all the time. Probably Ed Sullivan, too, although you never got to see him eat. Every time I saw a cowboy movie where the handsome lead would stay to dinner after having mended the fence, I was sure that meatloaf was what he had eaten." This is not a recipe book. These are stories that feature food. Why do you think that food is an important topic to center these really fascinating stories around?
You know, the best food writing isn't about food. And I think I have 30 essays to prove that, though they are food-centric, on everything from meatloaf to rhubarb, Italian beef to foie gras, or state fair foods, slaughterhouses, and goodness, a lot of pie. The real story...
a lot of pie.
A lot of pie. My writers were fighting over who would get the pie essay. I got some people mad at me, saying it was already assigned. The dirt, as they say, is what's behind the story. See, Elizabeth Berg's meatloaf that leads off the book, I think she told me in a conversation once that that recipe came off the side of an oatmeal box. What she misses is family dinner time. It's a very sentimental essay.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mention the word nostalgic, all I can think of when I was doing research for this book was a woman. She lived in an old order Amish community in northern Indiana, Elizabeth Koblenz. And she wrote by kerosene at night just about her family, the weddings, life on an Amish farm. Did she have 8 children? Her articles were syndicated in like 1,200 newspapers nationwide because people were dying to hear about scratch brownies again.
This is Emmanuel Berry. I'm speaking with Peggy Wolf, editor of the book Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, a collection of tasty stories about Midwestern food. For your own essay, you mentioned this earlier, the Door County fish boil, Door County in Wisconsin. I've never heard of this before until reading it, and it has this very kind of unique cooking process that takes place outside. Explain what a fish boil is for those of us who are clueless.
People think, ugh, boiled fish, okay, first of all. But it's like food as entertainment. When you go to Door County, there are, I want to say, 83 fish boils a night in all different kinds of restaurants, because it has become a phenomenal tourist draw. The fish boil used to be a way of feeding lumbermen in camps 150 years ago and feeding fishermen who had gone out on the Great Lakes and to catch fish, and they were hungry, and they did boil fish. At the time it was trout, lake trout, on the boat as they were coming back to shore, and the fish was fatty because the fish spent a lot of time in these cold waters. They do develop fat, and it did boil over. Those were, and you can believe either legend where it started. I mean, because Wisconsinites fight about was it the lumber camp or the fishermen, but it doesn't matter. It was a way of feeding large groups of people. And what happened was a restaurant, I think it was in the 60s, took it over and started replicating the fish boil. They would have on an outdoor gravel pit a setup. You could not get near the flames or the pot or your hair would be singed or worse. They boil water in a huge cauldron over a fire. They put the red potatoes in. They need 30 minutes to cook. And about 12 minutes before they're done, they put the fish in, and they are chunks of whitefish, nice 5-inch chunks. And the fish cook, and just as they're done, they throw kerosene on the fire below, which causes the whole thing to flare up and into this giant flame, which is why it's like entertainment. You stand back and everybody's zoom lens are out to capture the moment, and the water boils over. And what they're left with is cooked fish and cooked red potatoes.
Hmm.
And that's the fish boil.
Interesting. Never, ever heard of that. And it doesn't sound fish. Boiled fish does not sound appetizing at first, but I would definitely try that.
I didn't think it would sound appetizing, but when I first had it back in the 80s, I found that there was some sweetness to freshly caught. It was caught that morning on the lake at 5 a.m. and brought in on a boat. And so there you have same-day fish, which it had some sweetness to it.
Do you see Midwestern food becoming a trend on a larger scale? So Midwest themed restaurants are food on the coast in New York, L.A., that sort of thing.
I don't know. I think that's left up to the people who really predict trends. But if you look at Food Channel, Food Channel Network, they have for 2014 predicted food trends, and number one is Midwestern food.
Interesting.
Because what they're counting on for this kind of a review or whatever of Midwestern food is that it's all about farm fresh and local, taken to the next level, using the types of foods that are readily available in the Midwest. And to them, the East Coast is known for Italian, the West Coast for seafood, and perhaps it's just time that the Midwest became much more than a flyover state.
Peggy Wolf is the editor of the book Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie. She'll be in Kalamazoo at the Michigan News Agency along with contributor Bonnie Jo Campbell on Saturday afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. Peggy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
I Wonder As I Wander. Holiday music performed live here today on WKAR's Current State. We want to acknowledge our three players, all coming from the MSU Community School of Music, on violins Karis Smith and Stephen Smith, and our harpist Deidreana Potter. And we'll hear more from them here in just a few minutes. It's Current State on WKAR. For the second year, the Old Town Festival of Trees takes place at the 155-year-old Turner Dodge House. This year's festival runs through the 29th and features 23 trees decorated by Old Town businesses and Old Town neighbors. The trees are available to the highest bidders, and proceeds go to the Friends of the Turner Dodge House. And whether you bid on a tree or not, I'm sure a visit to the mansion just to look at the trees is great fun. Here to tell us more, Michael Beebe, president of the Friends of Turner Dodge. Welcome to Current State.
Good
nice
morning.
To see you. The Turner Dodge House was built way back in 1858.
Correct, yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the house.
Well, the house was built by James and Marion Turner. They built the house in 1858, and they lived there until about 1900, when one of their daughters, Abby Turner, married Frank Dodge, another political figure in the Lansing area. And when they bought the house in 1900, they did a major renovation of the house and added two wings on either ends of the house and also the ballroom. And the house stayed with the families until probably around 1958 when the Great Lakes Bible College bought the house. And that they had the house until the city acquired it in about 1974. And since then, the city of Lansing has owned the house.
What's the condition of the house in 2013 here?
It's in pretty good condition. Our friends group, we raise money through our events to maintain and enhance the interior of the house. And, of course, the city is responsible for the exterior painting and all the bills and, all the bills that go along with a big house like that. So
nice arrangement.
Yes. So it's somewhat of a struggle sometimes for the city to come up with a lot of the money for this because it's a very expensive house to keep up.
And the city has endured some budget challenges over the years. I mean, has that impacted the Turner Dodge house?
Not at the moment. Not at the moment. I think we're safe right now. There's some major renovations that need to be done on the exterior this next year. So we're going to be working. Our friends group will be working with the city to help perhaps with that. We don't know yet what that's going to entail.
Just don't hire anybody. Just don't hire anybody to get rid of the ghosts.
There are no ghosts. We just had a group come and check that all out, and they didn't find anything. So I don't know. I've been there late in the evening, and I've never heard anything strange. So.
But other people claim they have.
They have. So. The coordinator there, she says she hears the piano, somebody playing the piano when she's on the first floor when nobody else is in the house. But I question that. So,
and let's talk about the Festival of Trees here. Just the Old Town Festival of Trees. Describe some of the decorated trees. You've got 23 down.
Yes, there. I did want to correct you on the fact that the trees are not for sale.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
We have not done that at this point. This is the second annual, and the trees are just there for the public to come and view.
Got it.
But we have trees decorated by various Old Town businesses. A couple of the trees, Absolute Gallery in Old Town, one of the art galleries, Kathy Holcomb, the owner, did a tree in all wine bottles, which is very unique. It's just the coolest thing. It's got a lot of publicity. And then we have a tree decorated by Proust Pets that's all in metal fish. It's supposed to represent a coral reef.
Okay.
And that's really exciting to see. We have a tree done by one of our board members. It's all done in burlap. It's all created out of burlap. It's just beautiful. So we just have a wide variety of trees decorated, in different styles.
How long ago did you first walk through the Turner Dodge house?
Before being the president
of
the Friends.
I'm just curious, how far you go back with
that? I live a block away, so it's dear to my heart in the Old Town neighborhood. I mean, it's quite it's a landmark in our neighborhood. I probably was in the house probably 10 years ago.
Okay.
As when I became a Friends member,
But you did have a crew of Ghostbusters who visited the house recently.
Yes, we did. Yes,
tell us about that.
Well, I wasn't involved in that, so I really can't speak to that. Except they never found anything. That's so.
Well, that ruins everything.
They didn't
hear the piano player. Or they
no,
didn't
they
hear
heard
anything.
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
No, nothing at all. But at least they tried. So,
why is the Turner Dodge House worth preserving, in your view?
Well, because it's probably one of the few remaining historic homes in Lansing. If I can say this, Lansing, I don't think, has been real kind in keeping up their historic.
We just tore down the Arbaugh House and others just a few days ago.
Unfortunate. But it really is one of the most beautiful historic homes in the Lansing area, mid-Michigan area, in fact. And it is listed on the historic registry. If you haven't been there, you need to come and see it. We've gotten a lot of the original artifacts and art brought back to the house from ancestors, and it's just gorgeous, and it's worth keeping, and it's a historic place to entertain and hold events, whatever.
Yeah. Worth keeping in mind, a very special place for an event, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, and it is available for rent, for weddings or for private parties. I mean, we're always looking for people to rent the house.
Sure.
It's a beautiful place to rent. So,
what are your hours for the Old Town Festival of Trees then through the 29th, if we can cover
that? Basically, if I can get this all right here, it's open, the festival's open Tuesday through Wednesday from 11 to 5, Thursday and Friday from 11 to 8, and Saturday from 12 to 8, and Sunday 12 to 6.
Very impressive. It might have been
without
just,
a card.
It might have just been easier to mention a web address.
There,
why don't we
go.
Do that while we're at it, too?
The web is, I believe, www.lansingmichigan.com. I don't remember. Can you? It's right on the bottom of the You can probably
LansingMI.gov/TDodge.
TDodge. There we go. There we go.
There we go.
Yeah.
Go check out the Old Town Festival of Trees at the Turner Dodge House. We want to thank Michael Beebe, president of the Friends of Turner Dodge. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
Sure. That's the alternate melody for Away in a Manger. If it sounds kind of familiar, it is. And we want to acknowledge our players that you're hearing right now from the MSU Community Music School. Deidreana Potter is our harpist, which sounds fabulous. Karis Smith and Stephen Smith on violin. And we want to acknowledge all of our players that we've heard today from the MSU Community Music School. They've really brightened up the Friday before Christmas here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Right now, Current State's book reviewer Scott Southard offers his thoughts on Charles Dickens' holiday classic, A Christmas Carol.
We as a culture owe Charles Dickens a big apology. War on Christmas? Ha! It's nothing compared to the outright torture we have done to his A Christmas Carol since its publication in 1843. Movies in 3D, television sitcoms, cartoons, musicals. I have even seen a horrendous version set in the spring and starring Winnie the Pooh. His friend Rabbit had to learn the true meaning of Easter, and at the end, Tigger even winked towards the camera while saying, "What the Dickens?" The frustrating thing for me is, thanks to all these variations and adaptations, there are entire generations that only know this story through other people's retellings of it and not from Dickens' actual text. So why do so many run to pillage this holiday classic? Frankly, it's surely a money thing now. People have come to expect it, just like the decorated tree in the living room. And the sheer irony of this yearly cash grab around a story where one of the themes is the evil of greed would not have been lost on Charles Dickens. For Dickens knew poverty firsthand. His dad even spent some time in a debtor's prison. This financial trial in his life left Charles scarred, and the repercussions of it can be felt throughout all of his books. Yet, no matter how good, no matter how well-intentioned the adaptation or performance, nothing matches the sheer literary grandeur and mastery of the original classic. It is, in my opinion, perfect from the first sentence to the very last. Let's start at the beginning. Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. In A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens is tapping into a Victorian tradition of telling ghost stories around the holidays. It was also believed that on winter solstice, the longest night of the year, ghosts would be among us, a scene Charles Dickens recreates with Scrooge at his window. So Dickens, right from the start, is easing his contemporary audience into a story that would not have surprised them on a cold winter evening. But then he changes it, and this is where his genius sneaks in, for his ghosts have a message, a lesson. They are not simply saying boo. It is in the message from the ghosts that many Dickens adapters miss their mark. Yes, you can say the ghosts of past, present, and future, and you would be right, but you also be missing the gravity below those scenes. They are so much more than ghosts. Through the tour of his past, Scrooge remembers his lost humanity. In the present, he learns to see it in others. And in the future, he recognizes its existence after he is gone. This lesson of Scrooge transcends different religions, beliefs, and non-beliefs. It's almost too bad this tale is tied to a holiday that comes around only once a year. Everything else, possessions, wealth, and today's obsession with fame are meaningless next to the heart of a small, loving boy with crutches. For we all have the capacity to change like Scrooge, to grow, to make a positive difference in this world. Oh, if all the talent and money that has been spent on retelling this story each year were instead used to do some good, I'm sure Dickens would have appreciated that gesture a whole lot more. A Christmas Carol is Charles Dickens at his writing forte. It is a book made to be read aloud, and I hope you will try it yourself this year, like readers would have done when the book was first printed. And please remember that, as the clock turns for a new year, in Charles Dickens' eyes, we all need to be good to each other, rich or poor, or, as Tiny Tim once observed, God bless us, everyone. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And that is our show here for this Friday. We hope you savor this very special weekend before Christmas. A Merry Christmas to everyone listening from everybody here at Current State and at WKAR. Happy Hanukkah. Enjoy the weekend. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Also Aaron Young for engineering, Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll be going out with more music from players from the MSU Community Music School.